From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Obamacare's website under the microscope, NSA snooping angers U.S. allies, a report called Some U.S. Drone Strikes War Crimes, and two teachers killed at school. Hearings on Capitol Hill on healthcare.gov. Contractors said the government waited too long to test the website, just 2 weeks before the launch. Here's Republican Greg Walden of Oregon questioning contractor Andrew Slavitt.
What's the recommended industry standard for end-to-end tests before rolling up a major website like this?
Months would be nice.
New Edward Snowden revelations of American NSA eavesdropping on 35 world leaders, including top U.S. allies. German Chancellor Angela Merkel included. She was not happy.
Since we're talking about the NSA, I've made it clear to the U.S. president that spying on friends is not acceptable.
And two teachers dead this week, killed by students. 24-year-old math teacher Colleen Ritzer in Danvers, Massachusetts, and former U.S. Marine and Afghan vet Michael Lansbury, shot by a 12-year-old in Sparks, Nevada. Here's a 911 call.
Somebody brought a gun to school. They shot a teacher.
The teacher's down?
Yes.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, David Sanger of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? Your thought on healthcare.gov, NSA eavesdropping on France and Germany, teachers and students. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington today, Kelly O'Donnell, congressional correspondent for NBC News. Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
Always good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also from Washington, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal. David Sanger, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be back with you, and hello to Jack, and hello to Kelly, with whom we traveled a lot when we were all covering the White House together.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, lots of miles together.
unfortunately, no frequent flyer miles on Air Force One.
Yeah, but plenty of history. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kelly, and David.
Let's dive right on this. Here's an exchange. One Republican, one Democrat on healthcare.com. This was the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Their hearing that everybody was watching. Here's Republican Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana grilling.
You wonder why we're calling for a delay of the implementation of this law, a delay of the fines that people will have to pay if they can't even use the website. 50% of you who said you went to the website said you had a failure rate. You built the site.
Grilling or venting in that case. Here's New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone. He called the whole thing a monkey court, accused Republicans of using website glitches as an excuse, he said, to defund or repeal Obamacare.
Here we go again. Another cynical effort by the Republicans to delay, defund, or ultimately repeal the Affordable Care Act. I'd like to think that somehow this hearing is above board and legitimate, but it's not. The Republicans don't have clean hands coming here.
But meanwhile, still lots of problems aplenty with healthcare.gov. And of course, the whole program depends on lots of people coming in and signing up. Kelly O'Donnell, what have we really learned from the hearings? They're not finished. They'll have the Health and Service, they'll have Catherine Sebelius in next week. But what have we learned so far?
What's interesting about this, I was there for all 4 hours of that hearing inside the hearing room, and there were substantive points. Of course, plenty of the politics where people from both parties laid out the big overarching themes for and against what the health care law can do for the country. But in terms of substance, there were some interesting new pieces that add to the puzzle of what has gone wrong. First, these contractors talked about the fact that while they had each tested their own systems, and there were four different contractors, two of them really involved with the mechanics of how the website works, they had tested their own. But unlike most industry standards, where there's months and months, they claim, of testing of what they call end-to-end, where the entire system working together is tested, that didn't happen. They claim that the Department of Health and Human Services and the agency within that, known as CMS, waited until mid-September, 2 weeks before the go-live date, as they call it, to begin the testing. And from that point, they knew that there were problems. And they told us that they reported those problems back to officials working in the federal government, but they went forward anyway. Then another big sort of surprise, Many people, when they do online shopping for some other kind of product, have the ability to look around and browse first. And then if you see something you want to buy, whether it's shoes or an airline ticket, then you put in your information and you do the registration. That was the way the system had been originally created, where users could come in, look at the different policies that might be available, shop around, and then if they chose to go to the next step, commit their information. They told us in that hearing that the Department of Health and Human Services said 2 weeks, maybe even was 10 days, very shortly before the deadline, we don't want that feature. We want people to have to register first. And making that computer change and everything that did to the systems is part of what they say contributed to all of these problems. They each also said they had themselves tried to log on, even though they have insurance through the companies they work for, and they were doing it as a test.
Right.
And none of them could get through either. And that was pretty profound.
Kelly, is it clear why this change, pretty substantial change, would have been made so late? It's funny to be talking about this kind of detail, this deep in the game here, but why would they have suddenly, not long before this thing went live, required that people who want to come in and browse dump in all their data before they could do that? Was it a security issue, something else? Do we know?
We don't know a clear answer, but I can tell you that the witnesses said that the system which did permit the browsing was prepared and ready. And officials from CMS, this agency, did their first briefing yesterday, and they said that they felt that they needed more time for that feature. So I think there's some discrepancy that needs to be looked at. I don't think we have all the facts yet. And one of the benefits, kind of the unusual benefit of the way the order of this hearing transpired, is that you heard from the contractors instead of the cabinet-level officer, Secretary Sebelius, who for her scheduling reasons isn't coming until next week. Typically, the highest-ranking person would get to go first. And what this actually does is gives Congress, members in both parties, a chance to hear from these contractor-level experts. A lot of technical detail, but frankly, in this issue, the technical problems are the story, are the concern. So it's meaty and it's substantive. To hear from them first, and then to be able to prepare their questions for Secretary Sebelius, it might actually give us a better result next week in trying to find out who made these decisions, why were they made, what were the motivations. And those are big questions that do need to be checked out. And I think there's a lot of pent-up frustration because the system hasn't worked when something of this scale, according to these experts, they should have known, meaning the government should have known, that it would be problematic. And sure, glitches would happen, but not testing the system until 2 weeks before it becomes available to the entire country, they said they would have liked to have had months of time to do the testing.
Detail on the table before the spotlight turns higher. Here's Cheryl Campbell, Senior VP of CGI Federal. That's the largest of the healthcare.gov contractors, saying she would have liked more time to test. Republican Congressman from Michigan Fred Upton asking Campbell if she told the government about her concerns. You'll hear Campbell first, then Upton.
It was not our decision to go live.
It was not your decision to go live.
It was not our. It was CMS's decision. It was not our decision one way or the other.
Did you ever recommend to CMS that perhaps they weren't ready and they might want to delay the date?
It was not our position to do so.
David Sanger, so here we are walking through with a microscope the rollout of software at the heart of a very big government program. What's the import of all this likely to be, David?
Well, I think there's a political import and there's a technological import. Let's start with the technological one. This computer system is getting a huge amount of attention because all Americans need to go on it. And back in the days when I was a technology correspondent for the Times, we spent a huge amount of time on the question of the IRS's computer systems when they were first making this transition back in the mid-1980s. And it actually made what's going on in the healthcare system here look like a wonder of efficiency. So it took them years and billions of dollars and so forth. And you see the same happen in a lot of defense systems, both of which are systems that consumers rarely see. Now you sometimes get into the IRS system if you're filing electronically, but most don't see the back end. And it's almost always the same problem, which is the integration of different kinds of programs that are coming together. And that's always where trouble starts. And the idea that one would try to launch it 2 weeks after doing the first test of it, any computer professional will tell you, is utter madness.
So what does it mean for the program? What does it mean for the president?
Well, here's the big question now, the political question for the program. The argument through the shutdown was whether or not Obamacare was a wise way to go manage insurance and whether or not it would drive out private insurers and so forth. Once the Republicans lost that argument, they began to latch on to this because people I think there is some risk that people will confuse the success or failure of the computer system with the success or failure of the insurance system. And they're two completely different things. And one of them is an economic question about whether or not you can get young people to sign on and basically be able to keep the rates low because you've got a low-risk crowd in there. And the other is, can you execute on the program? But the fact of the matter is that if it becomes a sort of late-night comedy joke, it's going to be all the harder to get the healthy population, which isn't convinced they need insurance anyway, to go spend the time to sign up. For them, you want this to be completely breezy and easy. And I think the biggest risk to the fundamental program is that younger people who are desperately needed to make this work economically say, ah, it's not worth my time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Obamacare, website woe. The U.S. spies on its friends. They don't like it. Students killing teachers and more. David Sanger is with us from the New York Times. Kelly O'Donnell from NBC News and our own Jack Beatty. Just yesterday, Kathleen Sebelius, Health and Human Services Secretary, was asked about the problems with the Obamacare website. Here she is in Phoenix, Arizona. Reporter first, then Sebelius.
Who has been fired? Senator Bill Nelson said that people should be fired for the website not being up and running by October 1st. Who have you fired?
No one has been fired. My goal is to actually get the website up and running.
Who's been fired? Nobody. It's her goal to get it running. Trouble if it becomes a late-night joke? Well, it's there already. Here was The Daily Show's Jon Stewart on Monday going after the faulty Obamacare website.
So what are we talking about here? A few page freezes?
Many who want to sign up are having trouble just getting on to the website, logging on.
Okay, so the first step doesn't work.
Jack Beatty, how are you weighing all this? What do you see going on in the website uproar?
Well, I think that's very significant to hear from Jon Stewart. And this is the week that Obama lost Jon Stewart. And to lose him is significant because his key demographic are young people, 18 to 29. He's the second largest, next to the Colbert Report. That's their biggest source of news. It really hurts to be an object of fun on that show. So that's significant. And then, you know, you start to look at this. The president came out this week and he said, well, if you're having trouble with the website, here's a phone number to call. He gave an 800 number. Yeah. Well, someone from the Washington Post did that, and they told him, no, you can't sign up this way. So the president was contradicted within hours by his own someone in the bureaucracy. You know, Clay Shirky, who's the techno maven at NYU, his sources inside the government tell him that really what happened was this. The administration was petrified of an end-to-end test because it would produce failure. That's the point of such tests. They fail, you figure out why, and then you get it fixed. So they ruled out comprehensive testing because they didn't want to give the Republicans any ammunition to attack it. And so they saved all their errors for the for the rollout. And of course, that's not how things are done. So it may well be the White House, the question is, why haven't you fired Sebelius? The president may look in the mirror and say, well, my gosh, if we're the ones who said don't test and you know, we don't want to hear any bad news, then we're responsible.
Well, of course, there's a political timetable, or was here. I mean, this was the window.
Oh, absolutely. They had to get it right, so they felt. And, you know, you can understand their position. But there was not adequate communication. We just heard that in late September, the early tests were very bad. Well, at that very time, the president was going to Amazon down in a big warehouse down in, I think, Tennessee, and saying, look, this is going to be just like Amazon. You're just going to be able to get on. No one had told him that. Oh, Mr. President, the first tests don't look so good. There just has been a lack of communication. Some of the reporting throws light on that people within the system didn't want to communicate up the chain of command because they didn't want to be blamed. So mum was the word.
Mum or wishful thinking. Sarah in Dubuque, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just got to say, are we really this upset about a website not working? I've been listening to the news. I understand, every time I've used a website that's difficult and frustrating, you get unreasonably angry, and I've been there. But people are calling for people's resignations and talking about as it has any bearing on the Affordable Health Care Act. And it's crazy that this is, is our attention span this short that, have you ever been on a new website or computer program or any kind of new?
A little patience, you say. We all know the frustration of a buggy website, but a little patience. Sarah, let us hold that thought, and I appreciate your call. Get one more here from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Arco, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just want to echo Sarah's thoughts here. I think she was great. I think, in a sense, we're making a huge mountain out of a small mountain. All this scrutiny of this healthcare rollout, are we applying that to other programs that the government is doing? And I'm thinking of an example of the F-35, which has been way delayed and way over budget. And
that is a good question. Yeah, the F-35 fighter jet with all of its problems.
Right. Nobody's calling for resignation there.
Arco, you make a great point, and Sarah as well. On the other hand, Kelly, I absolutely hear that. Saw a Politico headline this week, is these hearings oversight or heckling? But they do have to have a good number of people in this system, including healthy young people, for this to work, Kelly. It's not just a question of, software timetables or political interest, is it? Isn't there a practical issue that's important for the whole program to work here, Kelly?
Well, it's important because it is the first step for people who are going to have access to the health care plans. This is how you do it. And we learned in the hearing yesterday that even people who are applying through a paper application, then someone working in the system takes their paper information and tries to get it right into that same portal, this same government website that is so fraught with errors right now. So it is the front door, so to speak, of how Americans who will be able to get access to health care eventually get it. That's why it's important. It's also important because, unlike lots of other products, this is a case where every American is affected by this. You have to have insurance. Either it comes through your employer, or perhaps you're going to participate in this marketplace, as they've called it, where you purchase insurance. And if you fail to do that, then eventually at some point, and the timetable, who knows, may slip, there's a tax penalty if you do not. So it is important in the sense that this is how people would get access. I think the callers are right on target. Sure, there are lots of other government programs fraught with complexities, and maybe they don't get the same scrutiny. This is the president's signature achievement in his first term. It's something so identified with him, something that's been politically charged for his adversaries. It's also a case where, yes, the actual insurance plans that will eventually be purchased and would go into effect next year, they're not directly affected by whether a website works or doesn't. But this is a crucial part of the process, and the fact that there is so much going wrong. And is it fixable? We need to find that out. There have been some improvements, the contractors say.
Good.
So it's a political problem. It's a technical problem. But it is also a means to getting those younger people involved, because their premiums that they would pay for insurance essentially finance for the older, less healthy people who are anxious to get insurance.
Right.
One of the concerns is someone with a chronic health condition who's not been able to get affordable insurance will invest the time, will try again and again and again to sign up with a troubled website. But a young, healthy person who isn't really that interested in buying insurance to begin with might not. And that could throw out of balance the economics of how this system was conceived in the first place. So it's important.
Serious issue right there. David Sanger, Rich Lowry with the National Review, conservative, of course, in Politico this week. Headline is Heck of a Job, Sebelius. And, of course, he's echoing, kind of taking revenge for the old heck of a job Brownie comment of George W. Bush after Katrina, Michael Brown, the FEMA head then, which was mocked endlessly for years. What about the leadership, oversight, effectiveness issue here around the president, David?
Well, there is a big question of leadership here, because this is a White House that prides itself on execution. I think about what they talked about during the bin Laden raid. Think about other cases, other disasters where the federal government has intervened, hopefully learning the lessons of Katrina. And so the failure for them to drive this issue is a fairly significant one. And it, you know, we'll come back to this subject a little later when we talk about the NSA spying, because what became evident yesterday was the White House claiming they didn't know that the U.S. was spying on the cell phone of a major national ally. And so the question comes down to what the information flow is going into the White House, whether people are, as Jack suggested before, keeping bad news out of the system. And that happened a lot in the Bush administration. It explains a lot about Iraq, for example. And it's almost always a dangerous problem that blows up on someone's watch.
I mean, let's go right to that. The whole NSA picture here, all kinds of eavesdropping all over the world. We've been hearing this drip, drip, gosh, maybe is the better word, from Edward Snowden revelations over time. Guardian with more this week saying 30-plus world leaders eavesdropped upon by the National Security Agency. And among them, and here's where the uproar came, the very closest allies of the United States here on Monday, including in Europe. On Monday, outside a meeting of European Union counterparts in Luxembourg, here's the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, telling reporters further action necessary to combat U.S. spying, interpreted here by Euronews.
This kind of practice between partners that violates privacy is totally unacceptable. We must quickly ensure that these practices are no longer repeated.
And outrage from the Germans as well. Yesterday in Brussels, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said trust between U.S. and Europe must be reestablished after claims that the NSA eavesdropped on her cell phone, interpreted here by EBS.
There needs to be trust between the US and European nations, and that eavesdropping amongst friends is never acceptable, no matter in what situation. As I said it back in June in Berlin, and again reiterated yesterday in a phone call with the president.
Real heat out of Europe on this. We'll look at that. Here was White House Press Secretary Jay Carney on Wednesday denying that the NSA was monitoring Angela Merkel's phone. Notice he's saying we're not and we won't. He doesn't say here anyway, we haven't.
The president assured the chancellor that the United States is not monitoring and will not monitor the communications of the chancellor.
Jack Beatty, what do you see? I guess exploding is the right word here.
Well, you know, the question of the week really to me to reduce it was, what is Barack Obama doing listening to Angela Merkel's phone calls, and what is he doing killing grandmothers in Pakistan? That wildly oversimplifies. But
you're talking about the Amnesty International charge of war crimes and
right,
drone attacks.
Right, right. But they share something in common, and that is that under this president, who had an opening, really, after the Bush years and after the, you know, my way or the highway of President Bush, to work with allies to reestablish U.S. prestige, to make our soft power effective where it needs to be and rooted in our standing, in our morality, in our transparency, Instead, he has our international position has deteriorated under this president dramatically. And in both these instances, the NSA and the drones, it's an unwanted confidence in technology, a kind of sense of, well, with these technological fixes, we don't have to worry about political problems. They'll eliminate them in Pakistan, and we won't have to worry about it with our allies. Well, that doesn't work, and any short-term gain here is so outweighed by the long-term damage to U.S. reputation, and I think it's just one of the great failures of this administration.
I want to go up to that level, but let's take it back down to the detail. David Tseng, you write a lot about espionage and security, have over the years. I mean, we've heard people come out and say, since these revelations about eavesdropping on European allies, that this is just standard practice. Everybody does it. Is that true in the volume that the NSA is apparently revealed to have been doing it?
Well, everyone does it, but not many do it as well as the NSA does. And so I think what you have to do is think about these Snowden revelations in several different baskets, Tom. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the one we're discussing this week is the one about surveillance of one's allies. You know, we are shocked to discover that we're spying on the French and the French have been spying on us. We're shocked to discover that someone's listening in on Angela Merkel's cell phone. The only shock to my mind there is whether or not the NSA actually does the calculation of, if this program becomes public, is the damage, as Jack suggests, to our diplomacy greater than whatever intel we could possibly hope to get from listening in to Angela Merkel's fascinating conversations on whether or not they're going to bail out Greece, right? So I think that the question sort of answers itself in the German case, that whatever they think they're getting out of it, it can't be as important as the cooperation that they have gotten from Germany over the years on counterterrorism, finding al-Qaeda cells, many of which have been in German cities, combating Iran's nuclear program. The Germans were an important side player in the program I wrote about in Confront and Conceal to try to cripple the Iranian nuclear enrichment program. So there are a lot of things we have going with Germany, and you have to ask yourself, why bother doing this operation? And the question the president has been asking, too late, I think, but he's got two committees now examining this, is, did we get ourselves into a position where just because we could do something technologically, we never stopped to ask, is it wise to do it?
Kelly, I can't help but think here. I mean, well, look at what Barack Obama's responsibility is here. I mean, after all, you know, he's the top guy. We've got listeners saying, doesn't the creepiness publicized with the NSA practices stick to Obama himself? But there's also a sense of the NSA in these Snowden revelations over time of the NSA just run amok beyond what standard practice or acceptable practice has been, ought to be, just too much data being scooped, Kelly.
Well, the sort of mystery of these spy agencies and the great capacity they have has been the stuff of movies, and it fills our imaginations. And now we're seeing some of the things we thought might happen, or some wonderful fiction writer put to pen and paper and on the movie screen, actually does happen. And people are blown away by it, some very deeply unsettled. And when you're talking about an important world leader like Angela Merkel, who has a very strong personal relationship with Barack Obama as president, not just the countries, but these two individuals being able to sit in a room and have trust between them, as she did with George W. Bush, as the president counts on these important skills of personal diplomacy, to have any bit of that trust eroded by a system that clearly the president is not personally directing, but it creeps in to the minds of our allies, and I think it is corrosive. It's something that the president needs to weigh, and I think the public is feeling a lot of discomfort about broad data collection, even if it's not the content of our calls like we're talking about here, but if it's just the data of when you called and what your email links are and all of these different skill sets that we want them to have in the pursuit of true terrorism.
But right into the personal cell phone of the German chancellor, maybe not a good idea with a top ally. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
In other news this week, a young girl known as Maria, found in a Roma or Gypsy community in Greece with adults not her parents. Many have looked to claim her. Here's the lawyer for the Roma couple that had Maria.
They loved her and they took her as her own child.
They loved her and they took care of her. As we speak, AP reporting that DNA tests have confirmed that a 35-year-old Bulgarian Roma woman is the mother of Maria. I'm sure we'll learn more, see more on that. Boy Scout leaders now face possible criminal charges for toppling an ancient rock formation at Goblin Valley State Park in Utah. They filmed it all and posted on Facebook, including one of them who has claimed he is disabled. They're all out as scout leaders. Here's a clip from the video.
Wiggle it just a little bit. Oh!
A lot of infuriated Americans watching that video, and comedian and entertainer Carol Burnett, 80, received the Kennedy Center's Mark Twain Prize for Comedy. Here's Burnett's trademark Tarzan yell. Okay, she's made us laugh. We're looking at a week in the news. The website, Obamacare, whoa, NSA spying on allies, students killing teachers, sad stories this week. David Sanger is with us from the New York Times. Kelly O'Donnell, congressional correspondent for NBC News, and our own Jack Beatty. We've got calls coming in from Germany, Angela Merkel territory. Here's a call from Dusseldorf, Germany. Jochen is calling. Jochen, thank you for calling. You're on the air in the USA.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Well, I just want to say two things. A, I'm outraged and extremely disappointed. Outraged as for the fact itself. I mean, originally we were told this is all in the war on terror, and then and so that allows the NSA to sort of fish for information wherever it can get it. But do they really think that they can get any information in the war on terror in Mrs. Merkel's cell phone?
Personal cell phone. What about the argument everybody does it?
That is almost as stupid as the fact if you have nothing to hide, we can listen to your telephone conversation. Of course, everybody does it probably to a different degree, but it's still illegal. I remember yeah. Israeli agents or spies being caught in the U.S. and sent to jail.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you, Johan. Jack Beatty was talking about President Obama's role here. David Sanger talking about the importance of trust. What about this president's stock and standing now in Germany? I mean, we look back, of course, this program reportedly went back to 2006 under George W. Bush. Okay, but here came Barack Obama, you know, open arms for him in Europe, and now things like this come out. What about this president's standing in your country?
That's why I said outraged and disappointed, and that's the disappointment. We all were looking at, or not all of us, but most of us, looking at Barack Obama as a change to the Bush quote, you're either for us or against us. And this president seemed, remember, I recall this, his speech in Egypt and the speech he gave in Berlin prior to the to the election in 2008. It was all open, and part of what the Republicans accused him of was that he was too European or appeared to be too European.
Yeah.
But it seems to be the same old, and as Jack was saying, probably, absolutely correctly, what is right now technically possible apparently seems to be done and has gotten totally out of hand. And I have to assume that this is not stopping with politicians or the ordinary citizen. How about industrial espionage? I mean, yeah. There have been cases, rumored, and everybody rejected them, that... I mean, we expect that from the Chinese or the Russians, but that plans for some wind turbines or high-tech stuff disappeared in Germany, and all of a sudden the same copies appeared in the U.S.
Johan, we've got it, and we feel that once you get that distrust going, it can really seep into all kinds of things. I'm grateful for your call from Dusseldorf, Germany. Glad you're listening there. Jack, let me get one more and I'll come to you. Lynn in Boston. Lynn, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. How are you?
Well, thanks.
So my question basically follows up on what the last caller was speaking about. From my perspective, I just heard one of your guests say, you know, the president can't be held accountable because, you know, there's too much going on. But my question would be, are there different standards for different presidents? And is this making light of something that is much more serious, and should the press be pursuing it in a much more vigorous way?
Lynn, I appreciate that. Jack, how about it? I mean, this idea, well, the president doesn't know exactly what's going on. Look, if the results of this kind of eavesdropping aren't ultimately part of the briefings that he gets in the Oval Office in the White House, I don't know what is there. I mean, who says he's not responsible? If it's not going to the top, what's the point of doing it?
Absolutely. And you know, what are we saying then? That he's not on top of his own government. I mean, he has responsibility. And if this is a case of the NSA running amok, someone should have at least told him about some of these things going on so he could exercise some judgment on it. But, you know, Norm Ornstein, who is certainly a defender of the president and a severe critic of the Republicans, of their fanaticism, really, he really sees this NSA business and the website business as part of a single story, and he calls it the failure of public administration endemic to this administration. And he points to a number of things, including the IRS scandals. Now, again, that was something the president didn't know anything about. Why didn't he know anything about it? Well, because there had been a delay, I think, of over a year in putting a particular political appointee into the IRS. That person, Ornstein surmises, might well have been the person to be able to say, wait a minute, these folks out in Cincinnati are running amok, Mr. President. Maybe you ought to look into this. That person wasn't on the job. It was a failure not to have appointed that person. The president is responsible.
Kelly O'Donnell, let's put this in a get-it-done context here. I mean, here we've got years to go in this presidency, and it looked just a couple weeks ago like, oh, the president's won on the shutdown front, Republicans in disarray. Then you get this sort of leadership issues or oversight issues. Call them what you will. He tried to change the agenda this week, or at least put the Republicans in an awkward position talking about immigration reform, asking for the Senate's bipartisan bill to be passed by the end of this year. Here's a little sound of President Obama this week talking immigration, tweaking the GOP in a way. But I want to ask you about his leadership. Here's the president.
Obviously, just because something is smart and fair and good for the economy and fiscally responsible and supported by business and labor and the evangelical community and many Democrats and many Republicans, that does not mean that it will actually get done. This is Washington, after all.
Okay, there's some attitude for the president, a little fun at the Republicans' expense right there. But what about this president's capacity at this point in his presidency to set and drive an agenda in Washington, Kelly?
Well, it is always a challenge for any president to be overtaken by events and to not be able to drive their own agenda. And the president was able to prevail in the standoff over the government shutdown. Not that he was benefited by that, except for the political reality that more Americans certainly blamed Republicans. So it wasn't necessarily a good thing for the president, but in a messy situation, he certainly appeared to come out on top there. And so trying to get back to things that he believes in. Immigration would be another signature achievement if he were able to get that done. It met enormous resistance in the House. We did see a big bipartisan level of support in the Senate. And by trying to put forward something that's on his game plan in the midst of all of these other questions that we've been talking about, where government oversight and government competence is being questioned, trying to get another policy change that, as he would argue, does have benefits economically, it has benefits for the culture of the country, those sorts of things. So trying to make that case, is it likely there's going to be progress on that? I don't see it politically in the short term. We still, if we've all kind of not quite gotten over the hangover of the government shutdown, we will have to revisit those big budget issues again in just a matter of weeks. So he'll be sort of drawn back into that debate. But it is always a hard thing for presidents to want to lead with the issues that matter to them and at the same time have to deal with the unforeseen, even if it's unforeseen things that come from within their own government, like problems with the health care law implementation or with the NSA. that's a real challenge. And so a second term is always, I think, a time where they're trying to get those last legacy items accomplished, but they're also met with a weariness. And I think the president has had real challenges in terms of leadership on these issues. It is, we've learned from the experience that only the worst situations get to the president's desk, and yet they are still judged by what happens deep within their government. And that's a hard thing. That's not something that a president can easily change. And it's unfortunate with respect to how the healthcare thing has rolled out, that he was put in positions where he was saying things publicly to encourage consumers to be involved, to encourage consumers to use the phone lines, when even that might not have been ready for real execution. And those are political problems. Those are messaging problems. And yet he has to live with the fallout from it. And to hear your caller from Germany talk about disappointment, that puts a pin in a balloon of how a president is perceived very, very strongly when people don't feel a sense of that aspirational quality that so many thought when they considered President Barack Obama from the beginning. So these are challenging times.
David Sanger, yes, please. Yes, David.
Well, I was going to say, just picking up on what Kelly said, you know, during the Bush administration, we spent a lot of time talking about Donald Rumsfeld's knowns, unknowns, and unknown unknowns. Okay. So Kelly talked here about the unforeseeable. But I think what is at this point hurting President Obama the most is the unforeseeable that should have been foreseen.
Yes.
And, you know, certainly.
Or the unforeseeable that may even be reaction to to the overall theme that you're setting. I mean, I'm not so sure that responsibility doesn't come back here. You've got a political timetable. You need Obamacare to roll out. It's going to roll out.
Right. And you knew what the deadlines were. You knew that it was going to require an extremely complex computer system. You work backward from that. And, you know, every computer system coming forward has glitches. There have been a lot of reminders this morning that when Medicare Part D came out, which was the prescription program under President Bush, it was not exactly smooth at the time.
No, fair.
But even then, you build on that experience.
I mean, even
same
on the NSA front, David.
For the NSA.
Yeah.
So for the NSA, I mean, we're in year 5 of this presidency, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand in year 1 or 2 not having a full sense of what is happening within NSA spying. I don't understand that at this point out. And if the president is saying today, well, look, we are not happy with where we are in the balance between our national interests and our spying programs, well, the question is, why didn't you ask that question in year 1 or 2 as he was beginning to unwind the legacy of these spying programs?
Let me ask you
And
about
let's face it, the Merkel one goes back to the Bush administration.
Yes, of course, I take that. But, I mean, and the president's saying he's worrying in public now about the balance. But it seems to me the deeper message from this president has been, we'll do what it takes. There were the, you know, sort of high ideals put out, but, you know, there's a kind of get-it-done impulse behind that. What about on the drone front? Here's another thing that will be a legacy issue for President Obama, and now Amnesty International calling some of these attacks war crimes. Now, I noticed with interest that that phrase didn't show up in the first, let's say, Washington Post reporting I heard on this, but it was reported everywhere out of their briefings abroad. What about that charge? Does that look like human rights over the top, or does that look like something that could come back to haunt this presidency?
My own view is that the drone program you have to look at as in Pakistan as an extension of the war on terror, the war on al-Qaeda, and you have to ask yourself the question, would we also have collateral damage and maybe more if the way they had gone after al-Qaeda in the Northwest Territories was bombing them from a B-52? And while there are certainly a lot of collateral damage and a lot of innocent people have been killed by drones, I think there's a fair argument to be made that far fewer were killed in the drone program than would have been using the techniques we had before the invention of the drone. That doesn't excuse any of the collateral damage, but that happens in war. I think the harder question for the administration is the use of drones in places where we right now don't have a congressional authorization, that it wasn't linked to 9/11. Because remember, we're 12 years out now, and even the administration has begun to admit that the authorization to use force that was passed right after the 9/11 attacks, and which has been used to justify these, is getting pretty remote from the events.
I want to take that to you, Jack. It gets thin when you've got the Pakistan's head of state in the country complaining very loudly about this to the whole world. In the end, who gets to decide here? I mean, the United States can say, you know, sorry, Grandma, the choice was B-52 or drone. But the world is going to decide in the end what was correct here.
Oh, it certainly is. It certainly is. I mean, and if there had been, if there is some yield, now David implies we are getting things done. We are killing the right people. Well, maybe we are, but what about the, you know, the other side? I mean, there's a piece this week in a Cairo paper by a former State Department official in Yemen who said this: for every bad guy we kill in Yemen from a drone, we make 60 new enemies for Al-Qaeda. Well, maybe that ratio doesn't apply in quite that dimension in Pakistan, but I bet it applies because, you know, finally, the president, I think, has misconceived this war on the border there. He sees it as about ideology. This is Al-Qaeda. Whereas people who look into this, as a fellow at the Brookings Institute just come out with a book, say this is about tribes and tribal society and saving face. And yes, there's this business of an honor, and there's this business of, you know, ideology in there. But that's just the front of it. But really we're at war with tribal societies who harbor grievances forever and will be haunting us forever.
Jack, bring it home very briefly. We barely got to the 12-year-old American, the 14-year-old American, alleged killers of their teachers. One with box cutter, perhaps one with a gun this week. An Afghan vet dying there in Nevada, a beloved young teacher in Massachusetts. What about the youth of these killers, Jack?
Oh, we just can't even begin to fathom this. The Times did a big piece on children who kill, take guns from the home and kill, but now box cutters. It's just awful.
That will take more time to sink in, but it's not at all pleasant as it does. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Kelly O'Donnell with NBC News, congressional correspondent there. Keep up the good reporting, Kelly, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
David Sanger, thank you so much for joining us. New York Times Washington correspondent. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.